I think that scansion and things like that are things that if you know what you are saying, are there anyway. That, you know, that it would be like the same, what's the method acting thing from the
sense
inside
memory.
Out, right. As opposed to from the outside in sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you know what you are saying, you will speak the words as they were meant to be said.
She says, and I have it.
Right, exactly.
Hello and welcome to the State of Shakespeare podcast. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And our guest in the studio today is Margaret Robinson. Hello, Margaret.
Hi.
Hey, Margaret.
How are you doing?
I'm great.
And cut.
Great interview.
Great. So far, so good.
We nailed that first question.
I think we did. God, we've got to come up with another one now. What could we?
We are going to be doing Henry VIII, Act Two, Scene Three, the scene between Lady Anne and the old lady.
Old lady.
Old lady.
Yeah, you gotta feel sorry for the woman reading that, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm nodding except like this is television.
This will be our first State of Shakespeare podcast involving a scene, as opposed to a monologue.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Who is this Lady Anne? Who is this person who appears in this play suddenly in Act Two, Scene Three?
And she makes her first appearance in Act One.
Tell us about that.
Well, she's there's a party at, I think it's at the Cardinal's home, and everyone's there, and the king comes in a mask and chooses to dance with Lady Anne and falls in love with her as they dance, has been taken by her. So that's the first time that we see her, and the next time we see her, everything is already happening. You know, the separation between Henry and Catherine is, you know, the wheels are spinning. It's in the works.
At the beginning of the scene, what does she know about Henry's feelings and what's happening?
Well, she knows only that she was admired by him. She also knows that he has overthrown his wife. And I am one of his wife's women. You know, I'm a member of the court. She is my mistress. And he has done her wrong. There are two camps here. There's the men's camp and the women's camp, and I am in the women's camp.
So you should be advocating for the queen.
Yes, and I think that I am. And my first thought when I read this scene was, ooh, maybe there's something, you know, what about this idea of deceit here? Like, how truthful is she being? Like, I had an instinct to try to find something in here that wasn't truthful, and I decided in the end that her protests are real.
So she doesn't have any feelings for him yet?
No, I don't think she has any feelings for him. I think that she sees the wrongdoing against Catherine, and that in an instant then, when the Chamberlain comes in and bestows this title upon her, the Marchioness of Pembroke, that her response is, well, I like when he first comes in, I like the entrance of a man into this scene, right? And he is the enemy.
Right.
You know, you are not welcome here. And then he gives her this great gift, and it's like Christmas. It's the best thing that's ever happened.
What is it that he gives her?
He gives her the title, the Marchioness of Pembroke, and along with this title comes £1,000 a year. And as the old lady points out later, for doing nothing.
And it's bestowed for no reason that anyone can discern.
That's right. So at the very end of the scene, there's this little moment of foreshadowing when Anne says, "It faints me to think what follows." And very quickly thereafter, she returns to the queen.
Now that's a very interesting line. So your interpretation of that line is that she is in dead earnest. Is there anything about the way that that line is structured which gives you clues to her mindset?
Well, yes, okay. So after the Chamberlain has left and the old lady is expressing her delight at what has taken place, Anne is very quiet and she responds to the old lady, single lines. And then in this that final little speech, she says, "It faints me to think what follows." There's a period, and there's a pause.
It's a short line.
Right. So you know, at least it says to me, that that is one moment where the foreshadowing is happening, and where there is also a moment for her mind to go somewhere where she hasn't been allowing it to go. And so that when she starts speaking again and says, "The queen is comfortless and we forgetful in our long absence," it's a cover up.
Interesting.
You know, I've had this thought. I've stayed with the thought for just a little bit. The old lady's in the room with me. Collect ourselves. Let's go to the queen. That's our job. That's where we need to be right now.
And that happens all in the space in that short line.
Right. And then, of course, she finishes by saying, "Pray do not deliver what here you've heard to her."
Right.
So
which
it's like covering our bases
this
here.
Is between us.
Yeah.
Right.
And the old lady has that delightful, she gets the last word.
Yeah, of course she does.
A thing that really struck me about this scene is how it begins. Let's start at the beginning.
It's a very good place to start.
It is a very good place to start. The beginning of the scene is with Anne speaking, and it seems to me, would you like to read the first speech for us?
Sure.
Would you?
Well, not for that, neither. Here's the pang that pinches. His Highness, having lived so long with her, and she's so good a lady that no tongue could ever pronounce dishonor of her. But by my life, she never knew harm doing. Oh, now, after so many courses of the sun enthroned, still growing in a majesty and pomp, the which to leave, a thousandfold more bitter than 'tis sweet at first to acquire, after this process, to give her the avant, it is a pity would move a monster.
And there you have it. That's the first speech.
And now I understand one of the lines I didn't understand.
Which was?
What was it?
To give her the avant.
Oh, yeah. Toss her out.
Right.
The old heave-ho.
Yeah. The old heave-ho.
Right.
The scene seems to begin in mid-thought.
Mid-conversation. Right. Yeah. So, you know, I would, you know, I danced around a little bit about what she and I would be talking about, and it seems, you know, clear that I am arguing for the queen, and that the old lady has probably said something to me such as, why are you so mad at the king? He likes you. He danced with you. You know, why, it's not such a big deal. You know, and we're having the same conversation that ensues.
When you first read a role, what do you look for? What do you pay attention to?
I don't know. I've always thought of myself as a bad first reader, that it takes me a very long time to, when I'm just reading it and not hearing it out loud, see or find what's there. Though what I thought was super interesting was when I got an email from you, Garrett, about this interview, and you wrote down a few things that we might talk about. And as I looked at them, I saw exactly what I, as an actor, started to look for when I, you know, started to look closely at the scene, which I thought was kind of sweet that another actor, you know, one who would hopefully never play Anne Boleyn,
yeah.
You know,
<There's> would, time.
would find and see the same things. I liked that. For instance, you know, how it begins and what's happening right before it.
So is that instinctual? Is it something that just you read it and you start thinking about these things? Or does it take you sitting down with the text and parsing it and scanning it? And
I think it's mostly, it's thinking about story, mostly. What's actually taking place, not trying to put anything on it, not even really trying to find anything in it, just very simply trying to see what is happening, where are they coming from, and what does she mean?
And how do you get to the bottom of what she means? Because there are some lines that I have questions about that I don't understand. So if you run to a line that you don't understand, how do you get to the bottom of it?
Well, in this case, I talked out loud about it with someone else, you know, and usually that involves trying to say the line. What's that word? Like a summary, you know, taking...
Synopsis.
No.
To transpose it into your own words?
Yes, thank you. To transpose it into my own words.
It's rife with irony, you being, of course, the biggest threat to the queen and at the same time, in this scene, her biggest advocate.
Yes, though that would, of course, be dramatic irony. And none of my business as the actor.
I love that.
That's something great to talk about. Yep. So when you say that that's dramatic irony and none of your business as an actor, what do you mean?
I mean that's something that anyone who comes to see this show most likely knows what Anne will become and knows more than Anne at this point. And that has no business right now in this scene in how I, as the actor, understand Anne.
So what you're saying, in a way, is that you have to stay in the moment as the actor because you know where you're going. And you can't play where you're going in Act One.
Oh, right. I mean, she doesn't know.
Well, Margaret Robinson's had the benefit of having been able to read the play.
And I guess that's probably why when I first read it, I thought, maybe there's something in here where she's, you know, not being truthful and looking to do that, to do just that, to play what actually ends up happening. What's the fun in that? Then, of course, you have to tell yourself. I think we probably do that a lot. Like, oh, actually, that's not what this is about. That hasn't happened yet.
I'm going to play the devil's advocate with you about this point of view that Anne is entirely naive of her own motives. And I would draw your attention to something funny that happens in the meter during the speech to the Chamberlain. And it happens around, the speech begins on line 79, according to our text. And it happens around line 83. That is an extraordinarily long line.
You have to give me the line because I don't have your numbers.
Yet prayers and wishes are all I can return?
Well, yes, this is exactly where I noticed this too. Although, you know what, actually, Garrett? No, I didn't notice it in meter, but I made a choice there, which perhaps was instructing me silently. And that is, in that when she first gets the title and she says, I do not know what kind of my obedience I should tender more than my all is nothing, nor my prayers are not words duly hallowed, nor my wishes more worth than empty vanities, yet prayers and wishes are all I can return. Something changes then. She's let something out. She's revealed something about herself. And she draws it back. Beseech your lordship, recovering, keeping the excitement down. Vouchsafe to speak my thanks and my obedience as from a blushing handmaid to His Highness, whose health and royalty I pray for. You know, so it's a very different ending from how she begins.
It certainly is.
So tell me what you saw in the meter.
That line contains an extra 3 beats. More worth than empty vanities, yet prayers and wishes. That last metrical foot and a half seems to be sticking out there like a sore thumb. Mm-hmm.
And then she obviously feels that.
It seems that.
Oh, I've said and done too much. I must restrain myself.
Something about those wishes that she has may, if she's not grasping, then at least she has a some sort of insight into her own secret desire.
I don't doubt that when she gets this title, that it is everything to her. But she's also just spent, you know, 2 minutes telling the woman who's still in the room with her that this sort of thing doesn't affect her.
And how important, this is one of our touchstone questions, how important is scansion and metrics to you as a performer?
I guess, I'm guessing it's important to you. I can tell.
We want to just examine everything, and no judgment whatsoever if it's not for you.
The answer can be it's not at all. Part of our goal in this is to discover what really is the process for actors who are really working, and how does that amplify what students are learning in their classes, or how does it...
As part of my training, it was never anything that was like... I didn't do much work in Shakespeare as in school. So my understanding of it comes from having been a student of literature and is not something that I attend to first when I am working on something by Shakespeare. You know, there will be questions that I'll have that I know can only be solved by scanning it. For instance, Anne's second little speech in this scene. I didn't know whether the word temporal should be said temporal or temporal. And if you scan it, it seemed to make sense that it should be temporal.
So your philosophy of sketching might be that it is a convenient shortcut somehow.
I'm going to be a little bit more generous than you, and I'm going to say you use it as a tool. It's a tool that if you need to use it, it's like a socket wrench, and if you need to whip the socket wrench out to figure something out, then you do.
But it also does teach us things. But it teaches us things. I mean, you can look for it, as in Anne's last speech here, where there's an obvious pause. After it faints me to think what follows. And then there's the thing that you brought up, where you noted these three extra beats, which is something that I feel as I was understanding the story and what's actually happening in that speech, I understood it. And so you can either understand, those three beats mean something, or there's the very nature of it makes you understand that something is happening there. There's a change. So it doesn't actually have to, might not actually say to yourself, there are three extra beats. What's happening?
That's why we talk about scansion and like how perhaps it might help and how does it help? And so it's not the starting point, but it still is there to be used.
Don't you think it can trip an actor up though, too?
Absolutely.
Afraid to to find moments where they're not speaking, to actually find what's it distracts sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's why I love this, what you're saying, is because you can get lost in the sort of the mechanics of it, right? But in the end, what has to happen is that you have to go with your gut or your heart or your opinion.
Right. For instance, if you're trying to be incredibly formal, okay, and you take Anne's first speech, I feel like that someone who was married to a certain measure would not feel comfortable making that second sentence a sentence of its own and the next thought a new thought. You know, that she says, here's the pang that pinches. All right, so now I'm going to tell you. His Highness, having lived so long with her, and she so good a lady that no tongue could ever pronounce dishonor of her. Okay, that's the pang that pinches. So that's one thought. And the next thing is a new, tops that it's something new. And I feel like if you don't, that a lot of people won't give themselves permission to separate things when they know that that is part of a whole. Does that make any sense?
I think it makes sense. To a certain extent, one doesn't want to be a slave to the meter, and one doesn't want to inhibit one's access to inspiration at any point. But I liken it, and I'm going to continue to play the devil's advocate here. I liken it to say a musician. It behooves perhaps a musician to be aware of the mechanics and the structure of the score that he or she is playing. And inspiration is a necessary component of that, but I don't think that the two are necessarily mutually exclusive.
You may be able to hit a home run once. You may just luckily swing the bat and connect with the ball and hit a home run, and that would be great. But in order to hit a home run 40 times over the course of a year or 50 times over the course of a season, you need to know something about mechanics, and you need to know something about the structure. And you may develop your own swing and do whatever you need to do, but without that knowledge, you're going to be swinging in the dark.
Yeah, it's like having searching for a fluid understanding, so it's something that you know that you keep in the back of your mind, that right. Informs but doesn't necessarily dictate.
As you guys have been having this debate, it strikes me about one of our questions we try to ask everybody, and it's the, are you a versist or a punctuationalist? Is that the term?
What the hell does that mean?
There we go. I love it.
I mean, I'm a fan of punctuation.
I think Mr. Gary, this is a good time to explain that.
The difference between versism and punctuationalism? It has to do with the choices of where to breathe. A versist believes that one is beholden to the line to the extent that one needs to breathe at the end of every line. A punctuationalist believes that the proper place to breathe is at the end stop punctuation.
I think I need you to be clearer. I'm not sure I see the difference.
Well, the difference is between a line of verse rather than as opposed to a line of when we refer to sentences in prose, we refer to the sentence as the line. But in verse, the definition of a line is more specific and limited to those to a single string of text. So the line in iambic pentameter, in strict iambic pentameter, the line is 5 feet long and contains 10 beats.
Right.
So versist would say, after the 10th beat, it's time to breathe.
I see. Well, we all know what I am.
Are we? I think the best answer was, what the hell does that mean?
There's a lot of bawdy references.
Sure.
Garrett has very kindly written out for us here.
He's highlighted them.
Yes.
He circled them. He put a star next to them.
Do you think Anne gets all the bawdy references?
Yes, I do. She says, the first time that the old lady says, you know, if your back cannot vouchsafe this burden, 'tis too weak ever to get a boy, Anne says, how you do talk.
For instance, do you think they'll understand what the soft chivalric conscience stretch it means?
Well, that's a great, how do you handle
They'll
that?
Probably get it, though. Maybe they'll get the idea of it, helped, aided by what she says before that, and that is saving your mincing. They will definitely know what that means, you know that she's telling, she's protesting too much.
That's the first quote that I thought of after reading the scene. Methinks the lady does protest too much.
Right. So they probably wouldn't, in just hearing it once, know certainly exactly what that means, you know, soft, cheerful conscience. But
so
they're going to get it.
They'll get the idea.
It took me probably 20 minutes on Google to figure out what soft chevrel was.
Share.
It's chevrel is the hide of a wild goat, which is elastic and can be stretched in any direction.
Are you blushing?
I'm blushing a little bit. But the real body comes from the conscience. The word conscience, which I blush to even go into what that is. I ought to be able to do that, but
go into it.
We're all grown-ups here.
Yeah, exactly.
It was how did Partridge refer to it? He said that it was a reference to the pudend.
I understand. The pudenda.
She implies she suggests that Lady Anne might be able to stretch her soft chevrel conscience
to receive
the gift
now
of the king.
Now you've gone too far. The gift of the king. Just want to shift gears?
Let's shift gears.
Let's talk about the shared lines, what that implies to you, the fact that you and the old lady are sharing lines together.
What do you mean?
I mean that, for instance, at the end of your first speech, you have 5 beats, and she finishes that line with 5 beats.
That's not something that I thought about.
Oh. And Gary, you pointed out the one line that wasn't shared.
Her first 4 speeches begin and or end with a shared line. And in fact, most of them begin and end with shared lines. But the first and only line in the entire scene that Anne doesn't share with another character is the line which is a response to the old lady's question about would you ever consider being a queen? And Anne says in line 43, no, not for all the riches under heaven. Which, when I read that, I see it's a giant red flag that says this is something that we treat a little bit different. This is, whoa, time out, red flag.
I guess what we're always about here in the State of Shakespeare is, does it change how you play a line? Or does it give you a physical thing to do? Or does it suggest a silence or any of those things?
Mm-hmm. Well, these things that you're talking about, there are little treats, though. I mean, I'm not sure that there's anything that you can do with them, but these are their little treats to see things like that and wonder about them.
And where were you doing Lady Anne?
I did a reading of Henry VIII at the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey.
Was the reading for anything in particular?
It was part of their reading series called Lend Me Your Ears, and it's for them to hear plays that they might do in future seasons.
Thank you so much for being our guest today on The State of Shakespeare.
You're welcome. It was great to be here.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
Thank you for listening. Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.